ultimately, purpose is felt not through metrics, but through stories. Humans have, for thousands of years, conveyed meaning, conveyed purpose, conveyed engagement, not by just celebrating numbers, money saved, tax prevented, but by telling stories.
Welcome to Compromising Positions. I'm Leanne Potter, cyber anthropologist and head of security operations for a major retailer.
And I'm Jeff Watkins, a cybersecurity enthusiast and CTO for a major tech consultancy. Together, we're the Tech Podcast that asks non-cybersecurity professionals what we in the industry can do to make their lives easier.
And help make our organizations more prepared to face ever-changing human-centric cyber threats. Today, we're joined by Dr. David Berkus, one of the world's leading business thinkers and best-selling author of 5 books on the topic of business and leadership. This is the first of 2 parts, so do join us next week for the rest of this fantastic interview.
David has worked with the leadership teams of some internationally known names such as PepsiCo, Adobe and NASA, so I'm really excited to dig into some of the insights he's gained over the years of working with these organizations.
In this episode, Storytelling Superconnectors, Unleashing Purpose Beyond Metrics in Your Cybersecurity Function, David challenges the concept of Dunbar's Number as we discuss the power of human networks and how finding the superconnectors in your organization will help you get your cybersecurity agenda in front of the right people.
Indulging a bit of schadenfreude there, David shows us how we can use the hacks and breaches of our competitors to demonstrate our value and purpose offering to the C-suite. And he also shares his unique insights on breaking down silos and harnessing the power of positive engagement in the workplace.
And as if that wasn't enough, how to move away from just metrics to make your security function shine. Basically, if you want to change the way your organization sees your security team, this is the episode for you.
We love this chat and we think you will do too, so sit back and enjoy our interview with David Berkus.
Welcome to another episode of Compromising Positions. We have an incredible guest with us today, one of the world-leading business thinkers. Always a pleasure to have on the show someone with such a great pedigree. He is the best-selling author of 5 books about business and leadership, winning multiple awards. There is nothing this man hasn't done, in my opinion. I'm a big fan of his videos on LinkedIn, which you need to check out. And the man in question is David Berkus. Welcome, David.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. You were too kind on that introduction, but thank you.
I am a real big fan and I'm very delighted to have you on the show. Your really sharp, punchy videos are just an inspiration to me. So tell us a little bit about yourself and what do you do all day?
Yeah. Well, I just came off of 3 hours of playing pickleball before this. Does that count as a what do you do all day? Love it. Love it.
Living the dream.
Yeah. I forgot to say, we've got a professional athlete on the show today.
Yeah, I'm not sure about that. I'm pretty terrible. But so I'm an organizational psychologist by training. Now sort of a writer and speaker by passion. My big kind of why, or I should say in line with my own book, my big who is I joke that I'm trying to make the workplace not suck, right? I think work is central to our lives. It's part of what all of us do. We fill 40 something hours a week of our life with work. And so I think it's too important to just, you know, leave it to chance. I don't think work-life balance is a thing because I think if you have a terrible job, that's going to affect all the other areas of your life too. So trying to make the experience of work as engaging and as purpose-driven as possible for people. And that started, again, down the road as an academic, being an organizational psychologist and what have you. But the real passion was, hey, if I'm going to make a change, I need to get these ideas out of the ivory tower and into the corner office, the co-working space, the home in a post-COVID world. I need to get them wherever work is actually happening. So we pivoted and kind of scaled down research and teaching and now work almost exclusively directly with organizations and associations to try and apply evidence-based insights to build better teams because teams are so central to our work. The majority of things that are impacting someone's engagement or disengagement, their experience of work is the boss they have and the team that they're on. And so that's what I focus in on.
Amazing. Could you tell us more about your books?
Yeah. So, you know, I in the early days of writing, I had a bit of what I jokingly call intellectual ADHD. So the first 3 books are sort of all over the place. My first book is called Myths of Creativity. It's a psychology book about the psychology of creativity, aimed at correcting a lot of our misconceptions about how it works, right? The second book is called Under New Management. That's sort of a future of work book, or at least it was 2016's best guess on the future of work. Now, here we are 7 years later. We got some things right, got some things off. What's amazing to me is actually how well we called sort of hybrid and remote work. I used to call it that sort of results-only work environment, but that idea that, you know, if you're doing your work, we want to see you, but we don't care how often you're in the office. So the days of the, you know, I think for most knowledge workers, the days of the 40, 45 hours in the office, waiting till your boss leaves so you can leave 5 minutes later. I think that game is over for a lot of people, which is great. Now, the trick now is doing the balance, but that was something we talked about in 2016. Third book is called Friend of a Friend, and that was all about the science of human networks, how humans form networks, how they're connected to each other. Interestingly, this is sort of divulges into to y'all's wheelhouse in that we looked at any scientific research on networks, which includes how computer networks and other communication networks are organized, because they share the same guiding principles or same emergent principles as human networks. So that was sort of my intellectual ADHD period. Anything that fascinated me, I was like, okay, I'm going to write a book about this so that I have an excuse to study this for 18 months and then write a book about it, right? That was my thing. Eventually, two things happened at once. The first is that I realized the through line through all of those books actually was teams. The most highlighted sentence in the first book on creativity is that creativity is a team sport. The second book is actually about the future of work, but it's all about how teams are going to organize around projects and do their work, what have you. And networks are people, and people form clusters, and clusters are another word for teams, right? So kind of had that realization. The other thing that happened was COVID forcing a lot of knowledge workers, my direct clients, to work from home. And so that one chapter on remote that I was hinting at earlier suddenly became very, very popular. And we extended that into a book that we wrote specifically for, I like to call it the Choose Your Own Dilemma book for remote leaders who didn't want to be remote leaders, right? You weren't counting on this. You had your team in person, and now all of a sudden you have to manage remotely. That book became Leading From Anywhere. And then that one we wrote sort of in response to what the world needed, just trying to be as helpful as possible. But now the newest book is called Best Team Ever. And that was the book that I wanted to write when I had the realization about teams. The difference was what the world needed, right, was teams in a remote context. But now that we're kind of in this, some are back in person, most are hybrid, some are still fully remote, we could talk about teams in a variety of different arrangements and talk about what's universally true about teams and team culture. So that's the newest one, Best Team Ever. Like I said, bouncing around all over the place in the first three books. But then we realized that that's my real kind of passion. And I think the place to make the biggest impact is to talk about how teams work together, because that affects so much about whether or not we're going to be successful or not at work.
Yeah, it's not the first time on this podcast, actually, somebody's mentioned human networks, kind of, or physical networks mirroring human networks, or the other way around. Do you have any like little tidbits or bits of wisdom on that, how studying physical networks has kind of helped think about organizational structure?
Yeah. So, you know, one of the things that you notice in physical networks, like if you take a network like the internet or even network connections built inside an organization, is the number of connections don't follow a normal distribution. They follow a power law, right? Some look at website. This is the whole reason Google works, right? Is that some websites get linked to each other and linked from far more often than others. And that follows that sort of power law. It turns out, even though we might think it's not, humans are the same way. You know, there was a social scientist, actually a anthropologist, who once theorized that, you know, the perfect size for a group, the perfect size for a community is 150 people. You might hear that sometimes referred to as Dunbar's number, et cetera. That's not actually how humans form connections. It actually looks a whole lot more like a technological network, like a communications network. There are some people who are legit super connectors in the same way that there are some sites or some network connections that handle all of the majority of the traffic. So that's one insight, right? Is that you want to kind of look for those to connect with who those super connectors are. I think the other most interesting one is that 6 degrees of separation is a real thing. The difference is it's actually even shorter than that. If we think about 6 degrees of separation, the idea that everyone in the world is connected by everyone else, we think of that as, wow, okay, 6 introductions and you could meet the president or the prime minister. Well, truthfully, I'm not actually all that interested in meeting either, but that's a whole other story. What I think is interesting is that when you look at it from a technological standpoint, when you do the studies that actually crawl, let's say, social networks, so on LinkedIn or on Facebook, et cetera, the number shrinks to 3 to 4. And what that tells me is that 6 is the number if you're trying to find a path by finding one person. Who do they know? Then who does who they know, and who do they know? But if you could crawl the entire network, you can find a much more efficient path, which is what technological networks often are set up to do. You have all of these redundancies, and you have all of these back channels, and you have all these things that make the network more resilient, but also make the connections quicker. So my lesson here, obviously your brain doesn't have the computing power to map a complete social network of a professional association and find the perfect person to ask to. But what I tell people is be open. Be open to the idea that the person you think is going to be the in to that particular company or that particular opportunity is not. In fact, it'd be better if instead of finding people who work with or friends who work with the company maybe you want to get connected to, it'd be better if you just said an open answered question to a lot of different people, like, hey, who do you know in whatever? Let's say you wanted to work in consumer packaged goods. Who do you know? Let's say you want to work at Procter & Gamble. Who do you know in consumer packaged goods? Just a broad question asked of a lot of people, and you'd be shocked where all of those different connections happen. Because what humans try and do is find the one path and find the perfect path, and sometimes it's a dead end. But what if you're thinking about the way a network application crawls an entire network, it searches every possible opportunity. And to the extent that we can do that, we're going to have a better chance in our own networking efforts. So that's two for you. And I could go on and on, but it turns out so many similarities between how humans form relationship networks and how other networks, whether it be, like I said, communications networks, telco networks, internet connections, even in nature, the networks that animals form, et cetera, they all have several principles in common, no matter what the type of network is.
So you're saying everything under the sun's a graph.
Kind of, yeah. I mean, you can draw, and you know what's interesting? We know this is true, but we never talk about it. Like in organizations, we will draw up like the perfect organizational chart, who reports to who and what have you. But you know who the super connectors are, right? I worked in university for over a decade. And one of the first things I learned is it didn't matter who the dean was and who the chair was. The admin knew everybody, and she was going to be the best way to get stuff done, right? She was the super connector in this case. And every organization has that, right? And I think you just have to kind of pay attention to it.
Yeah. One thing I say to a lot of people when I give advice of like, oh, how do I get security on the CEO's top priority list? Like, do it through the exec PAs, because they know everyone. I've really got something important to discuss. Be really nice to them.
Yeah.
And they're the ones that will really help you connect out into the wider business and really kind of raise your profile before it even gets to the CEO.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Teach them a little bit of like, security savvy. Teach them what a phishing email looks like, have them report it to you, and then sing their praises when they report one to you. And now all of a sudden the CEO is noticing, wait a minute, my assistant got a company-wide email from IT singing her praise. What's that all about? And now all of a sudden they notice. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And when it comes to networking, so you're talking quite a large scale there. So internally, when it comes to networking, so one of the problems security teams often have is they're quite siloed, quite isolated from the business. How would you recommend they start building those networks and being the best team ever?
Yeah. Well, you know, it's funny, that same strategy I said on the admin probably works the other side. I'll just be brutally honest here. Having worked for a lot of different organizations and hence worked with a lot of folks who are in IT and in security, et cetera, they're often, we feel like they're sort of the police, right? They're there to tell us to do things we don't want to do, to monitor our activity. During the pandemic, depending on the organization, they were sometimes told, even though almost every IT person I talked to and even security person I talked to didn't want to get involved in monitoring software and all that sort of stuff. Sometimes they were told to. And so now you have this negative opinion of them. To me, it's really a question of, I firmly believe that every role in an organization has a purpose. You know, I talk about in Best Team Ever, I talk about this idea of pro-social purpose. Every team and every individual should be able to answer the question, who is served by the work that we're doing? And that helps you draw your own sort of personal meaning from it, et cetera. But also the reality is there is an answer to that question. If there wasn't, we would have outsourced that job, right? It's cost inefficient to have to employ someone who does no service to the larger organization. So just because you're not making the product or selling the product or, I don't know, keeping the books on all of those sort of things doesn't mean your position's not important. That said, so that's where we need to start. We really need to think about how does the work that we do serve other people? And then how do we emphasize that more often than we emphasize sort of the compliance thing? Right? So before we're sending another email that's like, hey, just kidding. I know we told you capital letter, lowercase letter, number, and special character. Now we want passwords to be a sentence. Instead of sending out those kind of things, maybe celebrate somebody who actually protected you, right? Or tell the story of how, yeah, you had this vulnerability, but here's how bad it could have been. I think sometimes it's not just, hey, here's what happened that we were either victims of or that we blocked out. Sometimes it's just teaching people how it works. Let me give you a totally different example. It's not entirely cybersecurity, but it does involve. So have you ever dealt with kind of identity theft, for example. There are all sorts of different scams that people do from identity theft, from title theft, from stealing your social security to get a job, from even just like writing fraudulent checks because they figured out your account number, et cetera. And we had that happen to us as a family at one point. And I actually thought, we caught it quickly, we were protected, all of that sort of stuff. But I actually thought it was fascinating, like learning how the scam worked. And so what if we just did that? Instead of just saying, change your password so it can be more secure, be like, here's how this scam works. Here's how, like, spotlight on scams, almost a regular, almost friendly, sort of fascinating story. And then at the end of it, it is, and here's how we protect you from that exact scam, right? So you're doing two things there. You're teaching people more about the world behind it. Here's how this attack works. Here's how that attack works. But also, this is why we're asking you to do this thing. So I think those sort of things that tell that story, every role in an organization answers that question. It serves somebody. So it should be able to answer that question, who is served by the work that we do. To the extent that we can tell that story, not only to our own people to keep them motivated and engaged, but to the rest of the organization, we may end up taking the first step of breaking down silos, right? Which is getting people to feel like we're not the police, getting people to feel like, you know, we're not the sort of bad guys who are there to crush them or to block them from being more efficient or what have you. We're here to block all of these stories of the different ways we can get attacked that we've now taught you about.
Yeah, I think you've covered some of it all. I think that's really fascinating. Actually, there's a YouTuber I listen to who does like a summary of all the cyber scams one by one. He calls it Wham Bam, That's a Scam. And he does it in under 30 seconds. He literally goes, here's what it is. Don't click on it. This is why it works. This is how you can, you know, stop it from happening. And it's a really engaging piece. And we don't really do that. I mean, we tell people like, watch out for these emails. We don't necessarily go through the mechanisms. And I think I agree. The mechanism of how scams work is often fascinating. Like the fake people cheating, the voucher codes and things that, you know, the cards you can get at supermarkets, how that theft works is incredibly intricate and fascinating. And I think actually people might be more engaged if they learn a little bit more about what's going on under the cover.
Yeah. Or when I was at the university full time, we would get these random, if you're smart enough to know that the name in the email is not always the email address. And if you click the little caret, you can see the real email address. We used to get these random emails from the university president that just said, no subject, are you on campus? I don't know what that's about. I know it's a scam because it didn't actually come from his email address. It just came from someone who's mimicking it, right? But like, I'm really curious, how does that play? If I respond and say, yes, I am, what happens next? Like, tell me that story. Don't just tell me, hey, forward any weird emails you get. Like, how do I know they're weird unless I know what it is?
Yeah. I once worked in an organization and the CTO got a really weird email and he sent it to us and it was so odd. And even us as a security team, we were trying to work out, what is the scam here? And it was a really weird request. And in a safe environment, it had this link. And so we, in our safe environment, clicked on it and it led to a Facebook page, just like a personal Facebook page in, I think, somewhere like Singapore or something. I was like, what is the idea behind the scam? But what we did was, is we shared that email. We said, look, you know, even the CTO gets, you know, these emails and things like that. Like, this is what we've discovered from it. And, you know, this is how we spotted it with scam. And also the CTO spotted it with scam. But this is the investigation we did. And even though we didn't really have a conclusion what the actual scam was, people were really interested in, why did that link go to a Facebook page? And we had so much engagement. It wasn't necessarily teaching them anything because obviously we had nothing to say on it. I'm still perplexed to this day about what that was about. But it definitely was a scam, but I can't work out what the end game was. But what people were interested in is that whole process.
But what you did there is two things, right? One, you piqued their interest on how it works. But two, you celebrated the CTO for figuring it out. Now imagine if you do that for everyone that gets forwarded, even though you're just a random junior accountant who just got hired 6 months ago, you suddenly become in the IT's department's monthly newsletter as the story we celebrate because you thought, hey, that's suspicious. And it tipped us off to a new way people are attacking our organization, right? So not only are you piquing their curiosity, you're celebrating people throughout the whole organization saying you have a role to play in this as well, you know?
Mm, absolutely. And I think also sort of deep down, and I hate to say this, but I think sometimes we quite like these stories because some of the stuff these scammers do and these hackers do are quite impressive and ingenious. So they're these people are no slouch. You know, these are very creative thinkers in their own way. What they're doing is abhorrent, but how they do it is quite interesting.
I think if there's some kind of vulnerability, sometimes the principles of cybersecurity say basically it will be found and it will be taken advantage of. I remember many years ago they said, it's okay, you can open email, there can be no virus on emails. it's okay, you can open an attachment, you know. Attachments, at this point, nobody figured out how to put things like viruses into, or malware into PDFs or into images. And over time, everything we knew was true. People have found ingenious ways of getting around it and putting something naughty in there.
Yeah, or even just quirky things. Like I remember, I think it was Freakonomics, in the book Freakonomics, they talked about how like the Nigerian prince scam helped me get the money out. Like they deliberately put typos in the email, because if you're smart enough to realize this can't, then they don't want to even deal with you. They want the people who are so gullible, they'll overlook typos in the email, because those are the ones that are actually, why waste your time with people who are going to respond first, but then go, well, wait a minute, you're a really bad speller for a prince of a country. You know what I mean?
That's super interesting. I think the assumption has always been is that because English isn't necessarily the first language of some scammers, that this is actually a downside to their attack. But that little tidbit of information is because they're looking for the most gullible people, because one of the key things they're talking about generative AI at the moment is, oh, it'll make scam emails more credible because it will fix all of the typographical errors. And it's interesting to hear like that I've never heard that before. I find it fascinating.
Oh, really? Yeah, no. The Stephen Levitt, the economist behind the Freakonomics podcast, did a whole economics paper on that idea, right? Why you don't want to respond to every single person that replies to your email. You want to figure out who the most gullible people are.
And you want an easy mark.
Right, exactly.
You've spoken quite a lot about don't be the police. But how, in some ways, that is a little bit of part of our role. It's not my favorite part of the role. I try to use the word no discriminately, so it has more impact, more meaning. I much prefer yes, but let's think about how we do it in a secure way. How do you make the police more popular if there is an element of that to the role?
Yeah, so I mean, the first is you share far more, like it's a ratio thing. Yes, you're gonna have to say no to them at some point, but if you could share far more stories about the way in which your work is protecting the organization, and in particular stories that involve other people, not just in your department, that way you're seeing it, this is everyone's job. If the ratio is higher, it's going to make those no's much easier to take. They're still going to be there, right? Just like the police still have to deal harshly with some people who are obviously criminals. But the thing that, at least in the United States where I am, that's not happening enough and probably hasn't for the last 10 years is people sharing the stories of the way they actually are serving the community. If we can highlight those more, then it softens the nose. Right now, especially, I mean, I'm speaking anecdotally here from my own experience in a variety of different organizations, it often feels like the cybersecurity folks and even the IT department writ large are the party of no consistently. And then very rarely are there like, here's how we're protecting you sort of stories. And so if that's all you're getting, then yeah, that's pretty annoying. Right. So I think it's really that you've just got to focus in on those more often. I'll be honest, I'm not sure what the perfect ratio is. There is that whole 3-to-1 in interpersonal relationships they talk about, that for every negative comment to have 3 positive comments. Otherwise, people are going to start to feel like that relationship is strained, like that person is always negative because we have that bias towards the negative. So maybe that's the ratio. I don't know what it, I don't know what the perfect ratio is, but I know most of the professionals that I've at least worked in the same organization as, the ratio is non-existent. It's almost always just those no's.
Yeah. I don't really want, as a cybersecurity person, want to work in an environment where I'm always saying no to people. I don't want that. I want to enable the business to be able to do what it needs to do. So I think even for your own sanity, it's probably good to start thinking of how do you get out of that remit of being utterly the punitive police and instead being, you know, your, in the UK, we call it your local friendly Bobby.
Yeah.
I like the things you mentioned earlier about celebrating effectively the successes of people who have applied their cybersecurity knowledge well, you know, and have effectively helped defend, effectively making citizens' arrests on bits that could have gone further. You know, that's what it feels like. And I think that also touching on the people like to understand how some of these bad things work and getting people involved in capture the flags and hack days. You know, that also I found really does engage people as well and gets people thinking about security more.
Yeah. No, I totally agree. And then, you know, the other thing you could do if you're at a loss of those sort of things is anytime a company in your industry or even a company with a similar size or in a similar location is the victim of an attack, that's technically a celebration for you too. Right. So, you know, in the United States, I think the one that got the biggest headlines in the last couple months was the MGM hotels in Las Vegas.
Yeah.
Right. Huge, huge thing. There were hotels in Vegas that it did not happen to, presumably not because they didn't try, but because they couldn't find the same vulnerability, That's something we're celebrating. And that's the hardest thing. This is the dilemma from a motivational standpoint, right? We like to celebrate wins and we like to, you know, sort of deny failures. It's human psychology. Problem is, a win for a cybersecurity professional is nothing. Nothing happens.
Yes. Mm. Yeah.
right?
Which is so hard to prove to the CEO to give me more funding, because they can either turn around and go, great, nothing happened. Here's some more money for your project. Or great, nothing happened. I can cut your budget now.
But as soon as you can look to competitors, you know, the other hotels on the strip in Vegas presumably had some security measure in place that they couldn't figure out a way around. And so that's the reason MGM got attacked. So you could take that same thing. Hey, once we discover it, you're obviously not going to know it right away. But once all the forensics people come in and figure out what the vulnerability that triggered it all is, presumably that didn't happen over here because you had some security measure in place, or because a person, even better, right? Because somebody didn't click the suspicious email or however it happened. You can still celebrate that and go, look, this could have happened to us too, except that we had all of those measures in place. Thanks for funding all of those measures. And that may be the last part too, right? You're celebrating whether it's the CEO, CFO, whether it's an individual who did the right thing so they didn't have the vulnerability. Celebrate, again, this goes back to the stories. Celebrate that person too, so that they feel like they're a part of the team as well.
Absolutely. I really like the idea of that, actually. It's not something I've really considered. But you could even take that further as make that, and then getting a bit too technical for this podcast, but make that part of your threat intelligence piece is, you know, when your competitor, someone who's very closely related to you, the type of business you do, has a breach and all that information does come out, it's actually running the same scenario against your system and saying, actually, and especially things like emails, like, did we actually get that? And did we block that?
Right.
And things like that would be really interesting.
Yeah. I mean, if they did try something, that's the best possible scenario. But you can also just celebrate the fact that, look, they didn't even try because we have this in place.
No, I think that's really, really great. And I really like the idea a lot, actually. I think I'm going to mention that in the team meeting tomorrow.
Yeah. I mean, ultimately, the thing that all of this comes down to that ties into my work, because I'm not, as you can tell, I'm not a cybersecurity professional. I know a little bit about what my password's supposed to be like. That's about it. But ultimately, purpose is felt not through metrics, but through stories. Humans have, for thousands of years, conveyed meaning, conveyed purpose, conveyed engagement, not by just celebrating numbers, money saved, attacks prevented, blah, 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 but by telling stories. And so if we're trying to win people over to our side, if we're trying to keep our team motivated, even if we're just trying to get the rest of the organization to feel like they're a part of our team, you're not going to win that argument with metrics. You're going to win it with stories. Metrics are important. They're definitely important, but you can't feel a number, but you can feel a story. And so that's ultimately the through line through whatever it is you try, whatever, if you're listening to this, you do for the podcast and steal and apply. That's the ultimate thing. It is about how do we capture and tell the stories of why the work that we do matters.
What I enjoy about David's approach is it makes us challenge and redefine our perceptions of work, creativity, and connectivity.
Yeah, I really love that. And it's clear some organisations are more resistant than others to that challenge.
The idea of superconnectors and the similarity between human and computer networks was really interesting. And I wonder how many superconnectors we have in our audience. Are you one of them?
Well, it makes me wish I'd paid much more attention in my networking modules in university.
Wop, wop, wop.
Thanks. Links to everything David discussed in this episode can be found in the show notes. And if you like the show, please do leave us a review and a share on LinkedIn or in your teams. It really helps us spread the word, appease the algorithm gods, and get high-quality guests like David on in future episodes.
Yeah, it really does help. Like the 5-star review Kim left us on Apple Podcasts. We love reading this stuff, and it helps find us a new audience. And a big shout to all those who've nominated us so far in the European Cybersecurity Blogger Awards. That's Musa, Beck, James, just to name a few. Thank you so, so much. We'd be so grateful if you haven't done so already to jump to the show notes and drop us a nomination for Best Newcomer. It literally takes like a minute, 2 minutes max, and it's people's choice, so I think we're in a really good chance of winning here.
Well, I've got another good reason for people to like and subscribe.
What's that then?
So they don't miss next week for part 2 of David's interview, where we talk about his team culture triad and how doing a George Bailey, a la It's a Wonderful Life, might make you really appreciate your team's contributions to the organisation.
Yep, I can't wait for that episode. But we hope you enjoyed this episode. See you next time. Keep secure, and don't forget to ask yourself, am I the compromising position here?